Hi, this is WWR WindWise Radio.
WindWise Radio.
Hi, this is Harley Keisch.
And Susan Lockwood.
And we're coming to you from high atop a not-so-windy mountain in the Berkshires of western Massachusetts.
This week, we turn the focus to Vermont. We are honored to have on Luke Snelling, Executive Director of Energize Vermont, Jeff Gall, Hydrologist with Princeton Hydro, Steve Wright, former Commissioner of Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. And we're going to talk to them tonight about the struggle for smart alternative energy solutions in Vermont.
Well, good evening. Good evening. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Harley.
How are you doing tonight?
Fine. Yeah. Most importantly, how are our guests?
We're just good.
We're good.
Very good. We're delighted tonight to have the three of you on, and I know that we're going to have a great show. There's so much to talk about. The focus tonight is on Vermont and alternative energy solutions. What's the smart way to go? We're just so lucky to have you guys on. I want to start the show by asking each of you to just give like a brief description of your involvement, who you're working for, and your background a little bit. So I guess we'll start with Luke. So, hi, Luke.
Hi, Harvey. I'm the executive director of Energize Vermont, and we're a nonprofit organization with statewide membership in the state of Vermont that advocates for renewable energy solutions that are in harmony with the irreplaceable character of the state, but also contribute to the well-being of the people. So, basically, what that means is we support small-scale renewable energy development in the appropriate places, cited in meaningful ways, and we actively oppose utility-scale renewable energy solutions that either damage our natural resources or divide our communities.
Okay, fair enough. Well said. And I guess we'll just go right round. So, Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Again, my name is Jeff Gall. I'm a vice president with Princeton Hydro. We're a water resource and geotechnical engineering firm. My role in the projects in Vermont, I actually work for Energize Vermont. So Luke is my boss. And we've been providing water resource and engineering expertise consulting regarding projects that Energize Vermont is reviewing.
Now, which projects have you been involved in personally?
I've been involved with the Sheffield First Wind Project up in the Northeast Kingdom, the Lowell Kingdom Community Wind Project, in Lowell, Vermont, which is also in the Northeast Kingdom. I'm also currently reviewing the Deerfield Wind Project that's in southern Vermont near the town of Wilmington. On that project, I'm actually working for Vermonters for a Clean Environment.
Okay. And you're getting your mileage in, right?
Yes. I've been coming up to Vermont for years. It's definitely a beautiful state. I mean, as a water resource engineer, I love coming up and, you know, fishing and enjoying all the water resources in the state. So I was, you know, honored to be able to provide the expertise of my firm in reviewing these projects for compliance with the Vermont Water Quality Standards and the Clean Water Act.
Now, did the interest in hydrology or the interest in fishing happen first?
I was a little bit of both. I could sort of get up there and then maybe sneak out and do some fishing once in a while.
Okay.
Only after hours, though.
I see how it is. All right. So let me go down to Steve. Steve Wright, how are you tonight?
I'm great, Harley. Thank you for asking.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I sure can. I'll try to keep it short. I'm just basically a churlish old guy who lives at the end of a dead-end dirt road in a log house with my dogs. and surrounded by fishing rods and other implements of the outdoors. And I live in a little town called Craftsbury, a picturesque, little classic little New England town up in what we Vermonters love to call the Northeast Kingdom. And we're about 5 airline miles from the Lowell Mountains. And the proposal by Green Mountain Power to build a wind turbine facility on the mountains was what brought me into this issue. I'm technically retired, and my last professional adventure was as a climate change educator, given my fish and wildlife professional background with the National Wildlife Federation. And most of my time is spent as representing the town of Craftsbury as a volunteer in this particular effort. The town is technically a formal intervener in the, which means a party, a legal party, in the Lowell Mountain adjudication by the State Public Service Board. And I manage that case as best I can.
Okay. Now, what was your role at the Fish and Wildlife?
With the Fish and Wildlife Department?
Yes.
I was commissioner there under Governor Kunin back in the mid-'80s and had a great four-year run with the department, enjoyed my work. The people there especially enjoyed working for Governor Kunin, first woman governor in Vermont, and only so far.
Huh. And you didn't, you obviously from the accent or the twang, you didn't grow up in Vermont.
I did not, and I use the word, I refer to myself as a Vermonter with some risk, because I wasn't born here, and I get reminded of that often or occasionally, like every time I open my mouth. I grew up in deepest, darkest rural Georgia, and I came to Vermont 43 years ago for more hunting and fishing. I tried to get here ahead of Jeff Gall because I knew he was going to clean out every stream around.
That's how those New Jersey guys operate, I understand.
There's no threat of me cleaning anything out.
Boy, that's good news.
Well, listen, I think we're gonna jump right into this. I'm going to play a small clip of audio and have you guys respond to it. This is a clip that actually I stole from your excellent, I would recommend all of our listeners think about going to either Energize Vermont site, or it's been posted elsewhere, but in Energize Vermont site, there's a documentary that's in progress. Peter Bull is doing an excellent job of putting it together. And this clip is a little snippet of David Blittersdorf, who's the CEO of All Earth Renewables. This guy, David, has been in the business of making money from wind turbine parts, I guess measuring devices for wind turbine industry, big wind, for many years. And he has a little bit to say, and I want you guys to respond to what he has to say. So let's take a quick listen. It's about a 40-second clip.
We're not perfect. Solar's not perfect. Hydro has its problems. Wind has its problems. But in the scheme of things, when we have this monumental crisis of carbon emission and depletion of finite resources, we're going to have to do something. And that's the trade-off. It's not selecting one thing over another. We must do everything. We have to go offshore with wind. We have to use all the wind on the prairies. We have to use all the wind in our mountains in New England and the eastern seaboard.
So I guess this is what I always call the splat theory of how we fix what's wrong with the climate and our kind of trend towards global warming and climate change, which is you take everything and you throw it at the wall. Is that the right thing, or why not? I mean, why not use all of the wind in the mountains? Can we afford to not go all out like that?
Harley, this reminds me of the times as a child when you'd want four or five cookies from the cookie jar. So you'd ask your mother, "Can I have four cookies?" And she'd say, "No, you can have two." And I think the philosophy here behind David Blittersdorf in particular is, and other folks that are active in the climate change movement, including Bill McKibben, is we have to say we need absolutely everything and that we must make every sacrifice possible to get everything. Otherwise, it won't be enough. And the unfortunate reality is that Vermont is uniquely poised to contribute certain natural resources to climate change adaption that if we were to follow their prescribed notion of build everything everywhere, we'd actually be sacrificing. So we know that many of the relatively untouched connected habitats along our ridgelines in the state of Vermont are actually going to be great refuges for wildlife as if and when and as the climate changes. So to go and say, well, we need to build these utility-scale turbines across these ridgelines, it's our only solution, actually is not an optimal response to combating climate change and potentially adapting to climate change. A much better response would be more of a, you know, a systems look at it and say, well, what are the benefits and what are the drawbacks? And understand that to get the meager benefits of utility-scale wind in Vermont, the wind resource is very small, you're actually destroying something in many instances, whether it be the habitats or the high-quality water off those mountains, that you may very much need for proper adaptation down the road and into the future.
Well, I mean, don't all of the renewable being the devil's advocate, don't all the renewable avenues come with some impacts? I mean, solar has its impact. I mean, this is what he's saying. Everything has an impact.
I think that's a really easy line if you're a David Blittersdorf of the world to say, in the sense that it's, well, everything has its impacts, so let's just accept these impacts for this technology that I'm pushing. The reality is all the impacts are different per technology. And in the case of solar, the impacts are very controllable. You don't have to change a connected habitat. You don't have to create habitat fragmentation to install solar. You don't have to do solar in a way that will have profound impacts on a community. You don't have to do it in a aesthetically displeasing way. The nice thing about solar as a technology is you can scale and fit it inside a community in a manner that is requires much less total sacrifice for humans and wildlife than a technology like wind. So by simply saying that everything has, to some degree, requires sacrifices, really doesn't look at which sacrifices are appropriate for which areas and in which ways.
So what do you guys say to VPIRG, which makes the assertion that it would take 1,528 residential 5-kilowatt solar installations to equal the power produced by one wind turbine?
Well, as we know, you know, this is very much a huge mix, right? We know that our portfolio is not going to be totally one solution. It's not going to be all wind. It's not going to be all solar. It's not going to be all fossil fuels. The reality is that there will be a mix there. That's what we've seen thus far. But if you were to look at solar as a really great technology for us to roll out at a community scale and at a residential scale throughout the state, what you'd find is that you'd need to use a very, very small percentage, 1, 2, maybe even 3% of currently open land. And by open land, I don't mean farmland. So there's enough available rooftops, areas that are that you wouldn't have to cut down trees for, that you could build appropriately sited solar arrays and get the benefit of both going towards good, clean, renewable energy and doing it in a manner that, you know, it would absolutely change the working landscape but would not remotely have the devastating natural resource and community scale or community impacts that we're seeing with the recommended build out by the folks like David Blittersdorf or VPIRG.
Well, what's in the pipeline in Vermont? How many projects are there? How much in terms of like
industrial wind turbine he needs?
Yeah. So and how much do they expect to cover? 10%, 5%, 25%? What's the situation?
The current situation in Vermont is that there's two operating projects. There's a project in Searsburg, which was generally regarded as a research project. It's been operating for many years now. There's a project in Sheffield that just came online. It's a first wind project, came online in October. There's three other projects that are currently in some state of approval or construction. Lowell, as Steve mentioned, is currently being constructed. There's a project at Georgia Mountain near Milton, Vermont, which is it plans to begin construction at some point here. And then there's a project that's currently just received some approval from the Forest Service that's currently being appealed down near Reedsboro, Vermont. It's kind of the extension of the Searsburg project down there. And so those are the three that are really online, you know, looking to potentially be projects that are going to move forward. And then in addition to that, there's another, I'd say, right, starting off with the Grandpa's Knob project in West Rutland, there's one there that is looking to be a serious project. But there's another somewhere in the range of 5 to 10 projects that are ultimately looking to go in and start the permitting process. They're, I would call them prospecting projects.
Huh. So,
Harley?
Yeah, so go ahead. Is that Steve?
Yeah, it's Steve here. Could I jump back to just one aspect of the Blittersdorf comment? I have a great respect for David as a mechanical engineer and someone who's made a fortune in that arena of building measurement devices for, especially for wind, and now David's very much in the solar business. David hangs a lot of his arguments on the especially with regard to wind, but really on all renewables, on the carbon retirement or reduction or avoidance or whatever term you want to use. And the engineering studies that have been pointed out to me, and I am not an engineer. We have one on the show with us tonight, and he can probably comment on this. But the engineering studies clearly show that that we're reducing, that wind in particular has very little effect on reduction of carbon. And in fact, the entire electrical sector, which is what we're using now as our vehicle to reduce carbon in Vermont, really, at its current level, produces only 4% of our total carbon emissions in Vermont. 96% of our carbon emissions in Vermont come from three sources. They come from driving cars and trucks, and they come from burning home heating oil, and they come from agricultural operations. 96%. If you want to reduce carbon in Vermont, you need to go to one of those three sectors and get your butt in gear. You don't need to be tearing up mountains in order to plant wind turbines on them, because that does not do the job of carbon reduction. The best thing you can do with those mountains is, as Luke said, you can start protecting them, because they can actually, if you keep those ecological services alive and healthy, they can help allay, alleviate, ameliorate, or otherwise ease the effects of climate change, which is already upon us.
Yeah, and if I can, this is Jeff, if I can sort of add to what Steve just said, you know, that, and I've heard the arguments that, you know, we're trying to save the very mountaintops that are being affected by climate change. I can tell you from reviewing several of these projects right now that when you have to install wind turbines, I think people need to drive up to them and actually see the roads that are installed for these structures. It's a massive amount of earthwork. It modifies the hydrology. It definitely puts a stressor on the ecology on top of these mountaintops. And so there's talk about, well, climate, by doing this, we're also going to be helping protect these mountainous areas because they're also very sensitive. But when you're adding another stressor yet again on top of climate change, and again, I am an engineer. I wouldn't profess to be an expert on wind turbines. My head is usually looking down at the water. and the impacts on the water, I can tell you there's a huge impact on the water on these mountains. So I really disagree. I think, and as an engineer, it's sort of disturbing that the shotgun effect of trying to solve these problems, because I think there needs to be a lot more planning ahead. I think the turbine technology is actually getting way ahead of the ability of man to actually construct these things with a much lighter hand on the landscape.
Hmm. So let's, can we take a second and talk about Lowell, the project in Lowell Mountain? Is it, first of all, I keep thinking to myself that I'm sort of not really getting that right. Is it one mountain? Is it, I know it's, yeah. What is it consist of? I know, because like the ridge behind my house, there's three mountains that make it up. What is the actual proper?
There's a little bit of a story that there, Harley, which is, there's always one of those when you start talking about any feature, especially in Vermont. But when I came here in the late 60s and started hunting and fishing that area, I was hunting Lowell Mountain, singular. And that term was used to refer to the entire mountain range, which the more significant part of it, which runs from, it's about 12 to 15 miles long from the town of Irisburg south into the town of Eden. And I thought that was interesting, and I adopted that because that's what I knew I was supposed to do. But when the project came along people began to look more and more, as you just mentioned, to in your area, to looking at a ridgeline with four or five or three or four peaks on it. That's really what we have here. So now the proper reference is the plural, Lowell Mountains. There's only one of those mountains in that particular chain which has a name, Bigelow Mountain, and it's about 2,627 feet elevation, I believe.
So what's the size and scope of this particular project? How many turbines are going there?
21 turbines, 3.2 miles of ridgeline road, 2.5 miles of access road. What else, Jeff? Help me out here.
It's about 150 acres of land disturbance.
Yep.
So in order to access the site, they had to build 2.5 miles of road to the ridge. They also, on the ridge line, it's just about 4 miles of actual ridge line. I call it a ridge. It's to me, it's essentially a series of peaks that run southeast to northeast. And one thing I think also to, again, head to the ground in my profession is, in addition to obviously being a mountaintop, there's a significant amount of wetlands where I think the layperson would not normally think that there were wetlands, but the ridgetops here hold a significant amount of water. I would call it a series of peaks and water resources that provide a water source for the rivers and lakes that they drain to.
And it's worth noting that to build those three some odd or four some odd miles of roads, they're having to do extensive blasting into that mountain. There is particular places, and almost more than one up there, where they've blasted new cliffs into the mountain that are 40 feet tall. So they've really, really gone and altered the face of this mountain in a way that people equate with much, much grander construction operations, but it's happening there on a mountain in Vermont.
Yeah, if I can add to that, one of the reasons they have to build these roads is these turbines have 150-foot, blades. They actually literally have to drive tractor-trailer trucks and cranes and concrete to the tops, and that's why they need to sort of smooth out the grades. And maybe smooth out the grades is sounds like a more benign term, but as Luke had mentioned, some of these areas require on the engineering plans, there were 45 foot cuts into the mountain, as well as 45-foot fills. So there is a significant amount of disturbance.
And that's something that if you talk to the folks that are proponents of this project, they say, well, that's the price you have to pay. It's no big deal. It'll go back to the way it was once we plant some seeds and it's decommissioned 20 years from now. But the reality is that's something that doesn't go back to the way that it was. I mean, that's a fundamental lasting change to that mountain.
Right. I mean, the mountain behind my house was clear cut a couple of times now in its history since we got here. Once I think it was cut almost clear cut just to make charcoal for a smelting furnace for iron ore. But it's recovered now. There's a fairly mature mixed hardwood forest there now. And I think a ridge can recover from something like that. But what you're talking about seems like that's forever.
Well, most of 80% of Vermont 120 years ago was bare from sheep and goats and cows. And that's one of the aspects of this whole recovery process with the northern forest and the potential return of large predators like mountain lions. Who officially don't exist right now, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, at least in the eastern part of the U.S., and potentially wolves. So we know that the forest can come back. It has come back. We're often taken to task for maximizing the level of impact to the ridgeline when in fact, as Jeff and Luke have pointed out, I mean, I can't see the ridgeline from my house, but if I get in my car and drive a mile and a half, I can see the road cuts in it from 5 miles away, and that's the dominant geographic scene to the northwest from where I live. Well, not my house, but the town in which I live.
So what are the impacts to the hydrology that you've seen?
Well, I'll have to let Jeff answer that one.
Yeah, I've officially not been up to the project since construction began, but we've been able to obtain publicly available erosion prevention and sediment control reports that are issued. And I've been in contact with EPA and trying to get information. One of the things that, for example, when you're talking about 6 miles of roads in a very large unfragmented area, and 150 acres out of several thousand acres, it really doesn't sound like a lot. But what you're doing is, especially when you're constructing linear projects can have a much more far-ranging impact than, say, that same area in a square because it runs across multiple water courses and watersheds. And so what we've been finding, when we were reviewing this on behalf of Energize Vermont for the water quality certificates that the state had issued, there were no studies, for example, on groundwater impacts. I mean, there was discussion, there was in their permits, there was secondary review, but there was never an on-site investigation for water resource impacts. And one of our concerns was, you're going to intercept all this groundwater, and you're going to now take groundwater that provides an aquifer, so to speak, on the mountain to provide water later in the summer when there's generally less precipitation. And so what ended up, to be punny, coming to the surface is these reports that now they've run into much more water than they've ever anticipated. There's significant discharges. There was one report that they had to actually bring an extra machine in just to deal with the groundwater coming onto the site to divert it. And they're not just diverting it and bringing it around the site. It's being diverted now where it may have traveled, another several thousand feet down the mountain to supply a spring to a wetland or a stream. It's now being converted to surface water almost immediately. And so it's essentially sort of bleeding that mountain now of groundwater that it wasn't bleeding before. And so the long-range impacts, have yet to be, determined as far as from an ecological standpoint.
Well, Jeff, let me do this. I have a clip from Vermont Public Radio I'm going to play, and I want to ask you a question about it. So this is another hydrologist talking, and then someone from Iberdrola Renewables. So let's see what they have to say here.
Andres Turizo of Watershed Consulting Associates told officials in Wilmington that their town, which saw heavy damage in Irene, is a likely target for storm runoff from Deerfield Wind. Turizo claimed the Deerfield project's developer underestimated stormwater runoff at the site once the trees are removed and more bedrock is exposed. Turizo said Deerfield Wind's plan is based on incorrect assumptions that gravel roads required to build and maintain the turbines will absorb water. He said the state considers gravel roads impervious. Paul Kopelman is with Iberdrola Renewables, the company behind the Deerfield project.
We have nearly 50 wind projects in operation from coast to coast, and so this is an issue we have a lot of experience with, and we always strive to exceed state guidelines. And we performed a stormwater design analysis with the Vermont State Licensed Professional Engineers in accordance with state requirements.
Turizo, the hydrologist, had similar objections to the wind project in Lowell, which is under construction. He predicts that project will be a test of differing assumptions about the consequences of large-scale ridgetop development. For VPR News, I'm Susan Keyes.
So, Jeff, it seems to me like the guy from Iberdrola has probably been wrecking watersheds all over the country, but he's saying that maybe with proper drainage designs you can mitigate these effects, or what do you think about all that?
Well, there's the fact of the regulations, there's what's actually being designed. And even within the details of the design, there are assumptions that are being made. An engineer has to make certain assumptions, and these assumptions are, things like, the physical attributes of a site. And what Andres is saying, and I've reviewed the same information he has, is, for example, like he said, Vermont considers all roads impervious. It's been recognized that you can make a gravel road, and while it doesn't look like asphalt, it gets traveled on so much that it compacts, it gets filled in with sediment and fines, and essentially becomes impervious. On the Lowell project, there was an assumption that the rock for the road that's being used for the road would remain pervious, and that they could take more credit for runoff. As an example, on the turbine pads for Lowell, they made an assumption that there would at least be 1 inch per hour of infiltration. And following construction, to confirm that, they'll get in there and they'll scarify the ground if it doesn't have 1 inch per hour of water going through the ground. In other words, rain hits it and then it infiltrates at that rate. However, as we had talked about earlier, you've got 45-foot cuts in a mountain where the soil cover is maybe 5-10 feet in thickness. So when you're going down 45-50 feet into bedrock, I would like to be there and have the job to be able to stay there until they actually get one inch per hour into bedrock, because I don't think it's going to happen. And so
you'd be there till your retirement.
Yeah, and so what happens is the when you look at it, you're like, this isn't a real assumption. This is, in my professional opinion, this is not a real assumption. So, and secondly, one of the things that you have to understand about the regulations in Vermont is they do have what they call a recharge requirement, where water has to go back into the ground, but it's a flat requirement. It's based on a certain percentage depending on the soil. You don't actually have to replicate what was infiltrating before, so you technically are allowed to discharge more volume of water off-site. You have to control peak flows, which are the rate of runoff, but the volume itself, the amount of water coming off of those mountains, is not as regulated. So I do think that they've underestimated the amount of runoff coming off the Lowell.
So they've underestimated. They're also dealing with what seems like a kind of weak regulatory scheme that needs to be fixed. It just seems like a disaster in the making. Didn't you guys have a bunch of flooding last year? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, we've had terrible flooding, more than just Hurricane Irene. It's been a continuing problem. And the reality is that changing how that water comes off the mountain is not going to be a benefit for the surrounding communities.
Right.
Well, the project's been stopped once already for water issues. So that was in September.
Now, what's the current status of that project at Lowell? Is it are they continuing construction right through the winter? Or are they where have they gotten to? Are they starting to put components up there? Or
they were still blasting as of Thursday, but they're still tearing away at the mountain. They have Green Mountain Power has a certificate of public good awarded by the Public Service Board back in the end of May. Last year.
Now, what the heck is that?
Well, we call it a certificate of public greed, or a certificate of private greed. But that is the document, the golden fleece that Green Mountain Power has been looking for, striving for. In the permitting process, that's basically the permit to with its assorted conditions to build the project.
So once they have that in hand, they can just go ahead, regardless, or.
Well, they have been allowed to proceed with construction regardless of the challenges that the towns of Albany and Craftsbury have laid before them. These two towns are legal interveners in the public process.
Harley, go ahead.
They're legal parties in the adjudication of the whole process, and we continue to contest certain conditions that the Public Service Board has required. For example, right now we're working specifically on some wildlife protection issues that Green Mountain Power has proposed, and the board has found them adequate, and we've challenged that with a motion to reconsider. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a biologist.
I was just catching on to that, Steve.
Harley. Carly, do you understand how this process works? The way new generation sources are governed in the state of Vermont is that they have to apply for something called the Certificate of Public Good, and there's a body called the Public Service Board. It's a three-member board that then they have to appeal to get that Certificate of Public Good, or CPG. And that body legally doesn't have to decide the same way that a local town might. So in the case of Craftsbury and Albany, which Steve represents, those are two towns that are essentially bordering the project area, and they have concerns and interests that the board does not – they can evaluate it, they can choose to evaluate it, but they do not have to agree with the local host community or the surrounding communities, regardless of whether there was a vote or not or any of that.
So, Luke, who gets to appoint these guys? Are they appointed or elected? Or
they are appointed and by the governor and confirmed. But
so he puts his guys in there, and they can make whatever decision they want.
Yeah, I think there are six-year terms. Now,
holy crap.
So they're there for a long time, and it's not necessarily this governor that puts them there. But you know, the situation is that they are three people with an incredible amount of power, and the Public Service Board process actually governs rates, utility rates in the state of Vermont, as well as these new generation sources, and a couple of other things. And the reality is that this process, in our opinion, for how it is geared and capable of evaluating new types of energy generation in the state is woefully inadequate. This is a process that really has failed, especially when it comes to the impacts of utility scale wind. And this isn't—I'm not just saying this because obviously, you know, on my side on a lot of these issues has not come out on top. I'm saying this because we have situations where in this state, communities have said, we're worried about this. What about this? Give us our say. And they've said no. So from a standpoint of figuring out what the people want and whether it's appropriate, these projects in these communities, this process has failed. So, you know, I, for one, and I don't know what Steve would say about this, but I believe this is a process that is ripe for reformation, and I think we need to look at it and say, well, are there other processes that give more control to local communities, and are there better ways to evaluate the impacts of these generation sources that would at least be more all-inclusive and not essentially hand a license over to a developer to run willy-nilly? You know, one of the major issues with this process is there is really no way in which these orders are enforced. So now technically there's different departments and whatnot that are supposed to enforce different areas, but really there's no enforcement personnel that are responsible to follow these orders to the letter of the law and go out and visit these sites often. And there are people, but there is no specific group of individuals that are, you know, actively policing how these projects are living up to the letter of the law. So it's a very confusing process, one that doesn't give people great insight and doesn't really work well for communities and individuals.
Harley?
Yes.
Let me tell you a quick story here of one of the major events in the progression of this project. First of all, Vermont law does not allow towns to prohibit or to vote to there's no decision making really for towns with regard to utility developments. That's controlled, as Luke just mentioned, by the Public Service Board. So when Green Mountain Power got its eyes on the Lowell Mountains and did their supposed testing, which indicated there were adequate wind resources up there, they called for a vote of the citizens of Lowell, the voters in the town of Lowell, which is just, Lowell is essentially a mountain town to a great degree, with between the main spine of the Green Mountains and the spine of the Lowell Mountains, and in that low spot there is the upper end of the Missisquoi River, that part of the headwaters, of course, which flow off the Lowell Mountains. So Green Mountain Power set up a vote in Lowell, and they said if the people of Lowell don't approve, don't give us a favorable vote, then we will go away. At the same time, they were telling the voters of Lowell, by the way, if we do get a favorable vote, your town will get a 30%, we'll pay 30% of your property taxes. So you can imagine what happened to the vote. And that's been, we've been, I'm looking at this picture, this hammer here, on the screen, and we've been pounded with that hammer so many times as an example of how local folks do have control. Well, the people of Craftsbury, who actually can view more of the ridgeline than any other town in the state, much more so than the host town, in fact, didn't get a nickel's worth of an opportunity to vote in that process. The town of Albany, which will see most of the impacts that Jeff was describing, got no opportunity at all to vote on this project, as did Lowell. The town of Eden did not get to vote. The town of Irisburg did not get to vote.
It seems like it flies in the face of representative democracy that this country is supposed to be built on.
Well, it does. I mean, we have two tracks in Vermont that cover development issues. One track is the Public Service Board, and that's related specifically to utilities. And the other track is Act 250. It's the Public Service Board process is referred to as Section 248. The other process is Act 250. For years and years and years, there was an environmental board, which was a parallel to the Public Service Board. The Environmental Board ruled on commercial development with the exception of utilities. I served 7 years on that board. This project, had it come before the Environmental Board as a project to build a hotel or whatever at that elevation, would have been laughed out of the room. It wouldn't have gotten a nickel's worth of talk time before the State Environmental Board. The State Utility Board, on the other hand, can approve it, and that's what they've done.
Well, Steve, they don't, and the difference between the two boards is that the Section 248 takes into account the additional benefits to basically the benefits to the public of energy generation, correct?
Oh, to a great extent. And in theory, they also have to include, the Public Service Board has to include the so-called incorporated criteria from Act 250. But having been through that process, the Public Service Board, in my opinion, gives very little weight to those criteria. They certainly don't include the free ecological services that we derive from intact mountains in measuring the overall impact of the project.
Okay. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and listen to some messages from a few of our friends from around the country in Canada. And when we come back, we're going to have a question that one of the fellows in the chat room has been wanting to ask, and we'll see if we get some callers who might also want to talk to you guys. The call-in number, if you have a question or a comment, is 213-943-3683. And go ahead and call and light the lines up, and we're going to be quiet and listen to a few public service announcements.
Please join WinWise Massachusetts in Lee, Massachusetts, on Tuesday, February 28th. Expose the junk science in the Mass DEP's Wind Science Panel Report. The panel discounted or ignored research that suggested health impacts. The public hearing runs from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Lee Middle and High School Auditorium at 300 Greylock Street. This is the final hearing. A full epidemiological study is needed, say WindWise organizations across the state, who call for a moratorium on turbine siting.
Saturday, March 3rd at 7 p.m., there will be a free upcoming event at Memorial Hall in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Two speakers. The first is Michael McCann, certified real estate appraiser on the negative effects of industrial wind on property values. Michael has done numerous studies nationwide on wind project effects on property values. The second will be Robert Rand of Rand Acoustics, negative health effects from noise when living near wind turbines.
In Ontario, on Thursday, March 8th, the MPP for Huron-Bruce, Lisa Thompson, will bring forward a private member's bill at Queen's Park, calling on the legislature to pass a moratorium on further wind turbine development until there is a health effects study completed and the results addressed. So please take a moment, visit Ontario Wind Resistance, and help them send 1,000 letters to all MPPs. Support at Queen's Park on March 8th would also be appreciated.
On Saturday, March 3rd, from 1 to 3 p.m., the people of Port Elgin will assemble for a tractor parade to protest the CAW turbine. The parade is a joint effort of STOP, a 600-person-strong resident advocacy group, and the Bruce County chapter of the Ontario Federation of Agriculture. The goal is to unite rural and town residents to fight the onslaught of wind turbines. Decorate your vehicle and meet at 12:30 p.m. on Ebby Drive across from Bruce County Library in Port Elgin Industrial Park. Everyone with a tractor, truck, backhoe, or car is invited to parade through town to increase awareness of the collective call for a moratorium on wind turbines. Walkers are welcome. Bring a sign.
Common Sense Nantucket reminds all voters, that in order to voice their opinions at town meeting or at the town election, they must be registered to vote on Nantucket. You may register in person at the town clerk's office at the town hall at 16 Broad Street, Monday to Friday from 8 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. You may also request a voter registration form and mail it to arrive before March 12th. The voter registration forms are available through a link on the Common Sense Nantucket website, www.commonsensenantucket.org. Remember to attend the town meeting on Saturday, March 31st, and vote no on Article 13. This is WWR, WinWise Radio. If your group has an announcement they'd like read on the show, please send them along, and we'd be happy to help.
Okay, so there's a lot going around, obviously, in, around the whole country and the world. There's a lot of activity, a lot of protesting, a lot of call for some sensible solutions. And so I'm gonna bring up the first question. This is from Greg D, who's in our chat room. Greg, I think it's actually from Lisa's. I think Lisa is his MPP in Ontario, and so he's quite excited that we paid that public service announcement. Greg's question is about fire and rescue plans for the projects in Vermont. He says turbines do catch fire. How will this be dealt with? What plan is in place for like high angle rescue? If, for example, a tech needs to be rescued from a nacelle. So that's the question. Anybody want to field that?
Well, I it felt like I knew this permit backwards and forwards, Harley. I know nothing about any sort of fire and rescue permit conditions within the permit. I mean, I think most fire and rescue conditions in the permit, more accurately stated, I don't know. More likely, the GMP, if a turbine were to catch on fire, people would stand back and watch it burn. Because this is in a relatively isolated area. Now, if we had an unusual dry spell, that might represent some threat to the mountain. But if it's just up there burning, it might make some interesting fireworks. who knows? I don't know that there are any conditions relative to.
I don't remember about Lowell, but I think in Sheffield the Public Service Board has required some training, on-site training for the local fire and rescue teams, and potentially some additional equipment for them too. But my sense is whether that's adequate or not, who knows? And as Steve points out, these things are sort of a target for lightning and other malfunction often. So there is a bit of a risk there in terms of operating this massive machine off in a remote, very weather-intensive place in a rural area.
Yeah, it sounds like it's yet another thing they haven't really thought through, actually. I have another question for the three of you, actually, whichever one of you wants to answer this one, which is going back to the statement that only 4% of the CO2 in Vermont comes from generating electricity. Why is it, if that's the case, that the government is throwing all this money at building wind turbines that are going to cause so much destruction to the beautiful mountains of Vermont? Does anybody understand this?
Because the American Wind Energy Association has a great lobby, and it's done in the context of climate change action, and that's the holy writ.
Yeah, this is nothing more than a gold rush mentality. I mean, you talk about these 10 projects across Vermont that is pure prospecting. These are Small firms, 2-3 people, often backed by money of bigger firms from outside of the United States that see this as a huge boon if they can just get the project off the ground. So this is nothing more than finding a place where you can build these things, collect the subsidies, access the depreciation, and then move on. So it's really more about money than it is about being green. And frankly, well, that might be the same thing, but it also is wrapped up in this macro trend, as Steve pointed out, of, well, we have to respond to climate change and we have to build out renewable energy. So it's really a perfect storm of sacrificing things we care about to collect, to allow the private sector to collect money and government subsidies and move towards more renewables.
So do you guys have suggestions for what would be a better approach to solving climate change issues that doesn't involve wind turbines?
Well, first and foremost, without question, Steve pointed this out earlier, the number one thing that we have to do is more in the places that matter. You know, we're looking at 4% of carbon emissions coming from electricity in the state of Vermont. That's a small fraction. We need to look at heating oil and transportation fuel and agriculture and look at these sources of our carbon emissions and say, how can we conserve? How can we reduce the emissions in those areas? It doesn't make sense to look at the littlest one and hope that you're going to get the most amount of impact. It's actually sort of crazy. And then from an energy point of view, there are other technologies like solar that are simply better fits for our communities that allow us to move towards good, clean, renewable energy, but in a manner that doesn't sacrifice the things that are going to help us down the road to adapt to climate change as we progress.
Susan?
Yes.
I am completely convinced that the wind issue has nothing to do with carbon reduction or avoidance. Has nothing to do with it. That's only offered as a stalking horse or whatever you want to call it. It's not the real issue. The real issue here is the electric industry building facilities via which they can collect production tax credit and 1603 grants and make money and then run. This is no different from the cut and run loggers who were a cancer on the American West and Midwest back in the mid-19th century.
But why do you think that it has nothing to do with carbon?
Because it doesn't do the job. If industry was serious about reducing carbon, we'd be working primarily on the areas that produce carbon. And in Vermont, our environmental arena, our environmental community here is turning cartwheels over building wind turbine facilities. Not all of them. Some of them are just still have their head stuck in the sand, pretending that it's not a bad thing. But if you talk Vermont or if you talk New England, we use 11% of our energy, electrical energy, comes from coal generation in New England. So that's primarily where that 4% of carbon emissions that's where it originates. But if we were really serious about carbon reduction, we would attack the source. I got into this not too long ago with someone who continues to use West Virginia coal mining as an issue opposite Lowell Mountain. So with the thesis being, if we build turbines on Lowell Mountain and put them into operation, then we can reduce, then we'll reduce the impact on West Virginia. Well, it just doesn't work that way. The system does not work that way. Those are myths. They're not supported by any sort of scientific evidence and so on and so forth. So it's not about I don't believe it's about carbon at all.
So why do you think, you know, groups that, I don't know, I've always thought of PERGs as being really socially responsible groups. Why is it Vermont PERG doesn't get this?
Well, I can I'm always willing to offer an opinion, which may be and willing to climb out on small limbs.
That's why we love you.
Right. I can show you the scars from some of that as well. But here's what I believe, and I worked for 8 years as a regional representative for the National Wildlife Federation, and I'm not speaking for the National Wildlife Federation because I don't work for them anymore. But I know the environmental community. We spent within the Federation, we spent my last 6 years, 5 years with that organization in a full out effort, as did most other national environmental, groups, to get a big climate change bill. Well, we had a Republican administration during most of that time. And when Obama was elected, environmental groups put even more energy and money into getting a major climate bill. It did not happen. And the arena was crushed by this, emotionally and politically crushed by this. So now the approach that we have in a state-by-state way with the subsidies being provided, the PTCs and the 1603 money, provides an opportunity to do some of the same things that the environmental groups were trying to do via the federal government. When they knew that they didn't get a cap and trade bill, they didn't get any kind of serious bill limiting carbon emissions from the transportation arena. So they fastened on this particular issue of developing renewables as a face-saving device, an emotional self-face. Yes, face-saving. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, we get it.
Device. Right. And that's what they're doing now. They continue to do that. And they're afraid for foundation money support. They're afraid of individual giver support who represent the wind industry in many cases. So that's my lecture on that. Frankly, I'm embarrassed by the environmental community in Vermont.
Well, I
maybe that'll get some call.
Well, we do have a call. I'm going to take a call from Marie from Massachusetts, and let's see what her call is about. Marie, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much for taking my question.
Thank you for calling.
The question is just sort of a two-part question. The first part is, are there any large-scale solar projects going on in Vermont at this time? And then the second part of that question would be, are there the types of kind of state government support, financial supports in place for solar projects?
Marie, that's a good question. We're actually have seen several utility-scale solar projects in the state of Vermont, some done well, some, I would argue, not done as well as they could have been. We are seeing that there is some amount of support. I think there could always be more for something that's somewhat unique to Vermont called group net metering. Net metering, of course, is where you generate your own electricity at your residence and feed it back into the grid. Group net metering in Vermont is unique in the sense that they allow you to have one central project and then distribute the benefits of that project through the grid to the homes that own a share of the project. So we actually recently have some legislation as early as last year that allowed folks that are part of group net metered projects to earn somewhere in the range of 6 cents more per kilowatt hour than they're paying for electricity from the energy that's produced from those projects. So there is a bit of a financial incentive to do smaller scale solar in the state. Like I said, I think that there's absolutely opportunity to support that further. And I think it's crucial that we do that to successfully move towards renewable energy in the state and not sacrifice the very things that we love in the state. Generally, what we are looking at, you know, we now have three or four, I think it's three megawatt plus size utility-scale solar installations in the state. And what we're looking for out of those is for them to be done in an area without impact on a typically already disturbed land. We don't think we have to disturb more land to do those. We think we can put them in places where they're not terrible eyesores. We want to see solar built out in the state, and we want to see it built out in the most responsible way. And I think that it would be great if we can find more financial incentives to build the right renewables in the right places rather than all renewables everywhere.
Okay, good. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your call. Now, guys, we're at the end of our time just about, so I just want to thank you, and I want to give each of you an opportunity to just say a last word about what you would like to see for the future of alternative energy and so forth in Vermont. And then we're going to just I guess we'll have to break and we'll pick it up again. We have another some people that you probably know quite well coming in a couple of weeks. We're going to come back to Vermont. We're going to have Annette Smith from Vermont for a Clean Environment and Sue Morse from Keep Tracking.
Keeping track,
that's what it is. And so we will return. But I'd love to hear some closing thoughts. And I do appreciate very much your time and consideration for coming on the show. So I think who wants to go first?
I'll go first. This is Jeff, and I guess being announced to Vermont, so to speak, and knowing Vermont and having gone up there for years, I've seen and everybody has seen the news stories about how stringent the state is with protecting its natural resources. And when I started reviewing the permit applications for these projects, Lowell and Sheffield, I was a bit surprised at the differences in how those projects are reviewed. And I think if these projects were viewed equally as other projects were, such as ski resorts and other types of utilities like cell towers and things like that, it would be a much more even playing field, and it might be a little bit more difficult to get these projects built. The issue is, these are very intense projects. They do impact water resources, and they do need to be regulated in a manner consistent with, the frankly Act 250.
So
would be the way to go.
So Jeff, you would, if you had one thing to change, you would get rid of the alternative process and go back to a 250 process. And you think that would solve a lot of it?
Well, I think that, my professional expertise is a little bit limited, but it's in the environmental area. With the Public Service Board, from what I've heard and seen, is they get to weigh everything against energy, and if it generates energy, then things get approved over environmental issues. And to me, that's a concern because, as Steve had put it before, these forests and these mountains also have intrinsic value themselves and financial value. For example, flood control. It's a natural flood control. If now you impact these resources, the one thing about Lowell you'll have to understand is in all of these projects is there's a difference between sustainability and renewable energy. Lowell, as an example, is going to have over 30 or 35 stormwater control features that are going to be required to be maintained in perpetuity for the project's life. And so something that requires that much maintenance and that much control is, to me, not sustainable. It's missing the sustainable link to renewable energy.
Thank you.
I'm happy to go next. What I would say is that I think that in the state of Vermont and elsewhere, you can do renewable energy in a way that makes for happy communities and preserves our natural resources and still combats climate change. And I'm hopeful that this strife that we have in the state now is just getting us to that place. because I believe deeply we have to get there, and that it's going to be the only way that we are successful in the long term is if we can get to that place where we're aware of all these impacts and that we're actively finding solutions to them. Where we are right now with our policy, where we basically let energy and dollar trump all other interests, is profoundly unfortunate, and I don't think it's something, as Jeff pointed out, is sustainable. So I'm hopeful that we can move towards renewable energy solutions in the state that are a benefit, and ultimately continue to make the state of Vermont an absolutely wonderful place to visit, an absolutely wonderful place to do business, and an incredible place to live.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Luke. Steve, you get the last word tonight.
All right. I'm always the last guy. well, I want the legislature to do something specific, because I think a number of our problems right now, we saw this with the permit process for the Lowell project. We have a flawed system right now, and part of it comes from the legislature and the various responsibilities they've laid upon the Public Service Board and other units of government as we try to deal with this climate change issue. And I'd like to see the legislature take a deep breath, back off, establish a summer study committee, or one that lasts longer than a summer, and put together a team of middle-of-the-road people without financial agendas or other, but the only agenda that they'd be working on would be what's best for the state of Vermont in the long term, and come up with some new frameworks for legislative action and some new strategies for development of renewable energy resources. I believe in the good people in Vermont and their capacity for doing that. And at the same time, I'd like for someone to tell me, as a part of that process, what an intact, functioning mountain is worth. Tell me in dollars. I spent the last hour looking at my screensaver here part of the time. I hate to admit that. And that's a screensaver of the Lowell Mountains. I want to know what they're worth. And I'll put that against any amount of kilowatt hours that they can generate.
Well, I know that everybody down here that we're involved with are rooting for Vermont to get it right. We think that you guys are doing some of the smartest advocacy, and we know you have a big fight on your hands. And believe me, our hearts go out to you. It's enormously sad. It's been enormously sad to see the destruction of Lowell Mountain from afar. I can only imagine how devastating it is to all of you who live so close to it. We're going to wrap it up. I hope that everybody listening enjoyed the show and will recommend that they tune in next week. We're here from 7 to about 8 or whatever on Sunday nights, Eastern time. And we're gonna get out of here. Thank you, guys. Good night.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
And Harley.
Thank you.
You guys are amazing. Thank you for your great work.
Thank you.
Next week, we will be welcoming Eric Rosenblum and David Roberson, President and Vice President of National Wind Watch. National Wind Watch is a national coalition working to save rural and wild places from industrial wind energy development. NWW advocates an intellectually honest assessment of the benefits and costs of industrial wind development. Its objective is to be a resource of information and assistance for individuals and local groups seeking the facts about industrial wind power. We hope to see you next week. Thank you all very much. Thank you to our guests.
Good night from WWR, WindWise Radio.